This is The Annex, a sociology podcast. I'm Dan Morrison from the University of Alabama in Huntsville. Today, a special episode of The Annex where I talk with Dr. Jennifer Patrice Sims, an associate professor of sociology right here at the University of Alabama in Huntsville. Dr. Sims co-wrote the award-winning Mixed Race in the US and UK, Comparing the Past, Present, and Future, edited a volume on the sociology of Harry Potter, and is author of The Fallacies of Racism, which will appear from Polity Press in July 2024 here in the United States. Today on The Annex, racial ignorance, racism, and the distorted thinking that structures our society. Our conversation was recorded on May 2nd, 2024. Stay with us. Jen, it's so good to see you.
Good to see you.
We're both here at the UAH campus. I in the nook of the recording studio in the library and you at your office on campus. And so very happy to talk with you about your excellent book. Well, let's just dive in. We've all heard of the concept of fallacies. For example, the gambler's fallacy, that if you just keep playing, you'll eventually win. You know, you and I were just in New Orleans for the Southern Sociological Society, and Harrah's is right there. And
right there.
We can see the gambler's fallacy in action. Can you tell us how your use of fallacies regarding racism is similar to or different from usual uses of that concept? And how did you develop the concept for this book?
Yeah, of course. So the concept of fallacies in general refers to perceptions that are fundamentally illogical. The gambler's fallacy you mentioned is illogical because mathematically, each time you pull a slot machine or roll that dice, the outcome has nothing to do with previous times. So thinking, oh, I'm sure to win on the next round because I've lost so many times so far is illogical. The fallacies of racism are similar in that they're also faulty perceptions. Sociologists Mustafa Emebiar, Matthew Desmond, and later Crystal Fleming all include a few pages in the introductions of their books where they super briefly debunk five or six faulty perceptions about race and racism, and they call them fallacies of racism. Back in grad school, I was using Emebiar and Desmond's textbook in my race classes, and I found that students really needed more than just the paragraph or two on the fallacies in that book. Also, from grading student papers, as well as my own dissertation research at the time, I began to notice more and more of these faulty perceptions. And in particular, I noticed how they were often used to deny that racism existed or to emphasize how it wasn't, quote, so bad. So in my class lectures, and then later this book, I added to the list of fallacies, and then I also explained that they're not just simple illogics, but are patterns of thinking that are necessary to maintain group level inequality, which is different from fallacies like the gambler's fallacy, because one or even a bunch of those people at that casino rolling their dice and thinking they're due to win on the next round, that doesn't like segregate the French Quarter, that doesn't segregate the casino or give some patrons access to better goods or services there. But the fallacies of racism are a type of thinking that does have that unequal impact on people. So like the idea that racism only exists as conscious, malicious intent, what I call the mens rea a fallacy. That type of thinking was behind the 1970s case Milken versus Bradley that ruled that school segregation is only illegal if it's deliberate. Now, it's illogical to think that separate but unequal schooling is only racist if it's done on purpose. But that twisted perception is necessary if racially unequal schooling is going to be allowed and also be framed as legal and as socially okay.
Awesome start. Now we're cooking. Your book is organized from the micro level with three fallacies discussed there to the meso with five, and then macro with four. Identifying and thinking through the list of 12 fallacies must have consumed a good bit of time. But once that framework is in place, I imagine that the examples just pop out in everyday life. The book has several personal examples of the fallacies at work, and of course, many more from published accounts and social media. So how did you sort through all the possible examples? And was there a particularly good one that you had to leave out?
So this book grew out of my teaching, in particular, my sociology of race lectures and my introduction to sociology lectures. And so as an instructor, as a teacher, I'm always on the lookout for, quote, real life examples that might resonate with my students and help them make that connection between the classroom and the outside world and help them understand various sociological concepts. So most of the examples in the book are things that I came across pretty much anywhere. And I thought, oh, this might be pedagogically useful for my students. And you're right. Once the framework is there, then it is so easy to identify how ubiquitous this type of thinking is in society. Exhibit A is the fact that there are a few examples in the book that actually come from my students emailing me like, oh, Dr. Sims, look at this. It's like what we talked about in class. The most significant one of those, I actually thank in the acknowledgments. It's from my intro to sociology honors course. And it was from The Office, which is a show that I don't actually watch, but my students did watch. And as soon as I started talking about a particular fallacy, the whole class was like, that episode of The Office. And they started bringing that connection in. So I put that one in the book. To sort through what to include and what not to include, I tried to be sure that each chapter had a mix of types of examples. So research examples, current events, media, and some personal ones. But in general, I decided to leave out a lot of the really personal examples of where I've seen fallacies play out in my life. I do include some from my teaching and my research and my work, but there's the straight personal examples I did leave out. But a really, really good one that I thought about including, but ultimately didn't, comes from a dance workshop. I'm a dance mom. And despite there being kids of all races at this particular workshop, only white girls were selected for this particular special segment. And afterwards, one of my daughter's little friends, she was 7 at the time, she comes over to all of us moms and she goes, "It wasn't fair. They only picked white girls to do the dance." And before any of us other moms could reply, her mom goes, "Shh, that's not nice," and like hurries her away out of the workshop. And I just thought, wow, here's this great example of not only multiple fallacies that I talk about in the book, the mens rea fallacy, that it has to be on purpose. I'm sure the teacher wasn't being racist on purpose. The recognition fallacy, that there's something wrong with recognizing racism. The silence fallacy of her mother thinking it's not nice to talk about this particular type of inequality. But it's also an example of how children as young as like 7 can do the math and see inequality. But then they're socialized into these patterns of thinking that value ignorance instead. But I left that one out ultimately because I was trying to limit the non-work related personal examples. I didn't want to make the book all about like an analysis of my life. Also, the book doesn't really go into processes of socialization. So I just shelved that example, and maybe I'll do a dance mom memoir one day where I flesh it out more.
I bet there's a lot of content in the dance mom experience genre when it comes to some of these issues, and no doubt many others as well.
Yeah. Yes.
The nature of fallacies is that they're illogical, as we said earlier. Only from a white supremacist culture-serving framework do these fallacies make sense. And yet, they are commonly used by many people. One that I hear sometimes from white people is, "I'm not privileged, I'm poor." Or, "I'm not privileged, I never got a handout." Yet privilege and power are not the same thing. How do you respond to folks who would say that class divisions are the real problem underlying racism, or more generally, this denial of the privileges and certain advantages that come with being a white person in this society?
Yeah, so given that my research is United States, United Kingdom comparative, I do hear the class is the problem, not race, a lot, particularly on the other side of the pond. I generally respond by reminding folks that multiple things can coexist. It's not a zero-sum game. Race or class, gender or sexuality, religion or ability. No, the existence of one type of inequality doesn't mean another type does not exist too. And so I really focus on that too, because often, oh, the real issue is X, not Y, is actually low-key trying to say that Y is not a problem at all. And so there's lots of problems in our world. That is trite to say, but it is true. So basically, as with any perspective that is functioning to ignore that fact, when people say, oh, it's class, not race, I just try to get them to think just a layer deeper than the surface to consider how that common perspective, typically without them even realizing it, is actually supporting white supremacy, because it's attempting to ignore that white supremacy does still exist.
Okay, well, I'm glad you do that work.
Thank you.
This binary thinking, though, I think it's a real challenge, right? Mm-hmm. And oftentimes folks do fall into this trap of thinking that there is one primary axis of inequality and injustice that is primary, which ignores all of the intersectional inequalities that we know as sociologists. But your response reminded me that the fallacies you identify and provide examples for are super important, but you're actually addressing a deeper phenomenon, which is the way that white supremacy structures our very perceptions of the world and the frameworks that we use to understand that world, what Charles W. Mills called the racial contract. And related to this, you use Jennifer Mueller's theory of racial ignorance to explain the many ways that white Americans systematically deny the effects of anti-Black racism today. I think examining racial ignorance is important because as academics, we often think that social problems can be solved with education. What does the racial contract and the theory of racial ignorance suggest about efforts to educate white students about racism in America and
elsewhere? It suggests that we have our work cut out for us. It's going to be an uphill climb in 101 heat index weather. which as a fellow runner, I'm sure you know is going to be hard. So Jennifer Mueller does take this up in her work. In one of her content analyses of student papers, she found that some of them would literally not do parts of the assignment if doing them meant learning knowledge about racism that might be uncomfortable or that they didn't want to know. And I've observed this in my own classes too. Students will skip things that are uncomfortable or that may challenge them a bit too much or that they just don't want to know. So one example is I taught sociological theory one fall semester. And of course, the theory canon is mainly straight white men, but I made sure to assign women, people of color, and queer writers too. And I had a lot of athletes in that fall class, including 4 football players. And so the athletics office wanted detailed attendance notes, not just, oh, this is the number of unexcused absences that your players have had, but like which specific dates they actually missed. And so I turned that in. And then so looking that up, it turns out that the football players were not just skipping class like on a random Tuesday or just randomly, but specifically on days when we were scheduled to discuss theorists that were not white men. In fact, all 4 football players were absent the day that we covered Black feminism. So that really drove home to me that we academics and educators really need to understand that though we value new knowledge, we value it so much that we literally all make careers out of it. Many other people don't, and they value ignorance, especially if the new knowledge would challenge them a bit too deeply. So ignorance is bliss, as the old saying goes. So therefore, our efforts to educate students about racism in America and elsewhere, it's going to take more than just presenting them with good data. I opened the book by discussing how I used to naively believe that rigorous good data could automatically beat out stereotypes. And for some folks, that was true. And for many others, I learned that it was not. So how to teach those who prefer ignorance and lies to empirically supported facts, how to teach people like the student who wrote in my evaluations, I will never believe a word she says, no matter how many statistics she shoves down my throat. That's going to be a big question for education, social of education, scholarship of teaching and learning, and even social and school psychology going forward.
I get some of this when I teach race and racisms as well. Folks who have extremely negative things to say about my teaching and the knowledge that is shared in that class particularly, which is very interesting. But this seems really fundamental to the project of the university in terms of attracting the kinds of students who do want to have their priors questioned, you know, sort of their background knowledge and assumptions challenged. It's difficult, I think, in the environment that we're in now, where college is often seen as the path to a good job and used very instrumentally to get folks to understand that there are additional purposes to education beyond simply credentialing for a middle-class
career. No, I completely, definitely agree with that. I also feel like as social scientists, that it's our job to show the value of going beyond just the credential and the value of questioning your assumptions. You're always going to have those folks who are curious kids or they want to know how everything works, and they'll be super excited as college students to learn new things. And then you'll have the folks that maybe aren't as curious. And I feel like as educators, we can spark that curiosity. We can make people want to learn more and to encourage them to learn more. And maybe you don't enter college ready to question inequality in the world, but you kind of have your eyes opened a bit and you start to realize that, you know what, there is some value in questioning and learning a bit more.
We can do it. We can at least try.
We can do it.
We better try.
Okay.
I want to focus in on one of the meso-level fallacies that you discussed. So you talk about the self-defense fallacy, and that is the twisted view that people of color and allies defending marginalized groups from white supremacist abuse is wrongheaded or even reverse racism. So on page 121, you tell the story of a mixed race person reacting to a racist Asian stereotype. The white perpetrator here reversed the charge, loudly claiming to be the victim. This move reminded me so strongly of Darvo, deny, attack, reverse victim and offender, which we see so often in cases of domestic and intimate partner violence. Why do white people have such a negative reaction to their behaviors being labeled racist? One might think that it would be quite strange to live in a society so fully steeped in white supremacy and not be shaped by it.
Well, the key to understanding that is actually in that last part that you just said, society is so steeped in white supremacy. Ignoring that fact is required by the racial contract. So what that means is that it's most normal to perceive society, including elements within it, such as portrayals of different groups of people, as valid and as not racist. In the example you're referring to, the perpetrator was the white ex-mother-in-law of a mixed-race Asian woman I interviewed, and both she and the father-in-law were floored that their comment about Asians would be considered negatively. So think about it. Are you a cat or a dog person? What does your family have?
We have both.
You both? All right. Well, we'll go with cats. Let's say that I casually mention that cats say meow, and then you tell me that you're upset by that comment, right? We're going to look at each other like we're crazy. What's wrong with saying that cats meow? They do. Now we can replace cats with people of color and meow with negative stereotypes. And that's why white people like my interviewees' in-laws had such a strong reaction. As sociologist Raul Perez explains in his book, The Soul of White Jokes, many white people see negative comments about people of color as harmless or funny. And so the idea that such comments are negative, let alone racist, is just as preposterous as the idea as saying cats meow is being an animal hater. But having their worldview challenged wasn't the only reason that my interviewee's in-laws had such a negative reaction that day. My interviewee told me that she actually didn't tell her in-laws that she was upset by the comment or that she thought it was racist. When the comment was made, she just quietly excused herself and went upstairs to be alone. She said she was trying to calm herself down in private before rejoining the family. Her partner came upstairs to see where she had gone, and she confided in him her feelings, and then he went downstairs and told her parents. So that's why the story's in the self-defense chapter, because what her in-laws got mad about was not just that she thought their comment was racist, but that she left their presence. She was interrupting this like family, I think it was like a holiday. She was interrupting this family gathering in their view. And so their reaction was yes, to deny that they had done anything wrong, but also to demand that she come back downstairs. They perceived her feelings and her actions as an insult to them, that kind of reverse victim offender that you mentioned. And so you're right, the similarities between domestic abuse and, quote, racially charged incidences like my interviewee had should not go unnoticed. They help us see how racism is actually abuse and how common thinking about racism, like it's insulting the people to walk away from them if they make a comment that you consider negative, but they don't consider negative. That actually functions to just justify and perpetuate those types of comments, which I'm not going to repeat what was said, but you know, that perpetuates anti-Asian inequality.
I mean, imagine if this mixed race person who heard this comment had stayed, you know, like what does that indicate about the acceptability of those comments? So there are many ways to, and you talk about this in the book, there are many ways to respond when someone, you or anyone else, hears a so-called racially insensitive remark or a racist joke. It seems to me that walking away is one of the more mild reactions that one might have to that situation.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Which again, in the self-defense chapter, I talk about Black Lives Matter and other groups that are protesting against racial inequality or attempting to preemptively defend, and really note that it's not about the mode of self-defense. It's not about how it occurs. It's about the fact that it does occur. And I'm from Nashville. I know you have Nashville connections too. And the former police chief there was getting a lot of calls when Black Lives Matter protests first started many years ago. And then he put out a Christmas statement that says, basically, there have been no violence. All of these have been peaceful protests. So people telling me that I should shut them down, you're more upset at what the protesters represent and what they think than how they're actually behaving. And that's why this is a fallacy, why it's in the self-defense fallacy chapter. It's not about the mode of behavior. It's about the simple view that defending yourself or preemptively protecting yourself from white supremacist abuse, that there's something wrong with that. It's the view that there's something wrong with protecting against white supremacist abuse. And that view is necessary if the abuse is going to be framed as valid.
Right. And so for the perpetrators of this abuse, the abuse is actually understood to be normal and natural. And obviously the disfavored minority group is funny. They're funny little ways.
Yes.
Whatever that happens to be.
Cats say meow. That's just the way it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is good. Let's talk about another fallacy, the recognition fallacy, which is somewhat related. You know, we're talking about Black Lives Matter. The view that recognizing racism is problematic or even racist seems to also be related to the silence fallacy, the view that if we don't talk about race, racism will go away. And like these other fallacies, I hear this one all the time. What I don't understand is, why is silence the best option for problems of race, but not a good option for many other problems? It seems like when marginalized groups speak of their oppression, they're criticized. But when members of privileged groups claim victimization, suddenly their problem is worthy of attention and redress.
Yes. I mean, put plainly, powerful groups' concerns are acceptable to air and discuss and demand solutions to because they're seen as valid. They're cared about. As far back as the founding of this country, white men not having a say in the British government was egregious enough to be one factor in starting a war. But white women and people of color having no say in the new U.S. government was considered fine. And people who worked to get the right to vote for marginalized communities were stigmatized, punished, or even murdered. So we can see how the perception that talking about powerful groups' issues is okay, but talking about marginalized groups' issues is not okay. We can see how that works to maintain the inequality. If issues of those who were in power gets addressed, like getting white men in the 13 colonies their right to vote and participate in their own governance, then that can maintain their high status. And if recognizing and talking about issues like the racism and sexism that barred white women and people of color from political participation in the colonies, if that is stigmatized or punished, then it won't get addressed, and the subjugation remains how it is, which is beneficial for those in power. And this line of thinking gets applied to non-race issues as well. I spend part of the conclusion of the book talking about how the fallacies of racism can also help us think through culture-serving perspectives regarding gender and sexuality and ableism, etc. as well. And in all the cases, it just comes down to it's easier to maintain a system of power and marginalization of any kind if the dominant thinking is just marred in fallacies like this silence fallacy, that talking about problems of marginalization is somehow wrong, but talking about problems that those in power have is okay and acceptable. Whose problems are going to get solved?
I think one of the themes that we've been developing on the Annex, or I've been developing on the Annex as I do more of these interviews, is thinking about the status of liberalism and how broadly liberalism has or has not been applied in our country in particular, because I'm just so US-centric that way. I'll just own that as a sociologist. And the fact that folks like Charles W. Mills, I know there's some discussion about this, but it seems to me that Charles W. Mills didn't give up on a really robust, fulsome version of liberalism, one that would have features of multi-ethnic, multiracial, pluralistic, egalitarian, democratic participation in society. And so the silence fallacy is another way to draw this line between, you know, who's in and who's out in our political system, who counts as a full member of society and who doesn't. And if you can prevent marginalized groups or oppressed groups from speaking of their suffering, then you can ignore that suffering, obviously, and pretend that you have accomplished the liberal democracy that you tell other people and the rest of the world that you have achieved.
Yep, 100%.
In the future, we'll have actually a political theorist on. I mean, your work does, I would argue that your work does get into this, Dr. Sims, but we'll have a person who specializes their whole career in political theory to talk about liberalism and what's going on there. But speaking of not talking about inequality, we live in Alabama, which just passed an anti-DEI so-called divisive concepts bill that also included a trans bathroom ban. What do you think of the logic of this legislation, which prevents lessons that would force adherence to one or more so-called divisive concepts?
First, let me preface this too by saying that my answer reflects my personal assessment as a sociologist and in no way whatsoever represents the views of our university. Okay, now the lawyers are satisfied. You noted that the Alabama ban prevents lessons that would force adherence to one or more, quote, divisive concepts. And this is a perfect example of racial ignorance at work. I've been in sociology classes as a student or a professor for 24 years across 4 U.S. states and in 3 countries. No one is forcing adherence to anything, let alone the boogeyman that this DEI ban labels as divisive concepts. So one of those concepts, for example, is that one cannot force people to believe that one race is innately superior to others. Social science classes literally teach the opposite of that. Most every sociology textbook ever printed has a statement that race is socially constructed, not innate. And most every psychology textbook ever printed says that prejudiced ideas, stereotypes, and biased behaviors are learned, not innate. So it's actually been white supremacy, not K-12 teachers, not college professors, not DEI administrators, that are the ones that has viewed one race, white people, as innately superior to others. But the Alabama DEI ban writers and their supporters have to do mental gymnastics and ignore that historical fact to claim that it is teachers in DEI programs who are being divisive and who are claiming that one race is innately superior to another. And you mentioned the bathroom ban. It's the same thing. The bill says that bathrooms must only be used by people assigned that sex at birth. So we're all just going to ignore the fact that bathrooms in all of our homes are used by people of multiple sexes and genders every day. So my daughter and my nephew can use the same bathroom when they're at my house, but when I have to bring them to work sometimes, when they have to come into the office, it's, oh no, they need to use different bathrooms now. And so where's the logic? Oh, sexual predators might be in the bathroom. No, statistics show that the vast majority of sexual predators are cis. They are not trans. But like the DEI parts, that bathroom part has to ignore facts. As such, the whole bill only makes sense when we remember that Alabama and many other places in the US still want white cis hetero domination in society.
The whole point about how for a long time what has been taught in schools is white supremacy, right? And the society being structured around a white supremacist, cisgender, heteronormative patriarchy as not only the default, but the good for society is not speaking on behalf of the University of Alabama or any of its affiliates, a special ironic twist for this bill.
Yes.
Well, we are going to see what happens in our state when the bill actually goes into effect October 1st, 2024. So folks who listen to the X, stay tuned. Maybe we'll have more to say about that in future episodes. More broadly, stepping back a little bit from the details of your book, how do you see your work contributing to discussions about teaching and learning about racism and white supremacy?
Yeah. So again, prefacing to do my due diligence to remind listeners that I'm speaking as a professional sociologist, not a representative of our university. I see my work as having crossover potential to help open up discussions and identifications of solutions of problems of racism and white supremacy, but also issues of gender and patriarchy and heteronormativity and more. Once we can understand how often common thinking is actually an attempt, even a subconscious attempt, to legitimate or maintain the status quo, which is unequal, then we can begin to cultivate not just habits of thinking more critically, but we can also start initiating more habits of acting more critically and from a more informed and justice-oriented place.
I know as a discipline, we're having a conversation about the role of sociologists as individual scholars and in sociology as a discipline, an academic discipline, a social science discipline, a discipline that respects norms of evidence and good theorizing, about our role in confronting or addressing challenging political and social situations. And really, this goes back at least as far as Becker's Whose Side Are We On? So all that to say, this scholarship is certainly contributing to one side of that conversation, which I endorse personally. But not everyone agrees, and that's fine. We can have that conversation. And I think one of the things that's happened, at least recently, with some resolutions that are being thought of right now, is it has brought a bunch of ideas and perspectives out. And so now we know a lot more about what our colleagues think and the kinds of reasons and logics and justifications that they use. And I think that's all to the good, regardless of how you feel about any one particular statement or any one particular stance. All right. Well, I appreciate your book for several reasons. The first is that the fallacies framework helps me to think about all the arguments I've heard that function to support the system of racial dominance that we call white supremacy in the United States. I have heard so many times, and this is one of the fallacies you talk about in the book. So I'll be talking with another white person and they'll point to a black person that's prominent who is giving a line that denies the systematicity of white supremacy in the United States. And that person will say, well, look, X person, let's not name names, but X person, you know, says this, you know, they say that racism was solved in 1964. And so it's over now and we can go back to doing what we were doing. We shouldn't be concerned about it.
Yeah, I call that the token fallacy, and I name names in that chapter.
Yes, you do. Well worth it. Well worth it. So that's the first reason. The second is the book helps me think through responses that might open up a conversation rather than shut it down. So how would you like readers to use the book?
I was thinking about this, and let me first answer what I don't want readers to do with the book. As I say in the conclusion, I don't want readers to read the 12 chapters and say, you know what, right, well, I've learned these 12 fallacies now, so I will be sure that I don't think that way. For one, I only wrote about 12, and that's not an exhaustive list of ways that people think that low-key supports inequality. But second, even if I had made an exhaustive list, changing one's thinking or being more aware of one's thinking is just a first step. It's a really good first step, but it's a first step, not an only step. So what I do really hope readers do is use the book to learn to identify inequality-serving thinking in all of its forms wherever they may encounter it. So for a really recent example, and speaking of another example that I had to leave out of the book does not include any examples from the recent conflict in Gaza. So let me first just go on record again to remind readers that I'm speaking as Dr. Jennifer Patrice Sims, a sociologist, not as any sort of representative of my current employer. So now that that's done, this book was literally going to press when it became clear that what was going on in Gaza was an attempted genocide. And in line with the recognition fallacy and the self-defense fallacy, people are being stigmatized. They're being called anti-Semitic for being against the genocide, and sometimes for even just naming this as an attempted genocide. Right now, May 2nd, we are seeing professors and students across the country assaulted by police for peacefully protesting the ongoing assault of Gaza. But the perception that if you're against Israel murdering 34,000 Palestinians, it obviously means you love Hamas and hate all Jews. That is peak fallacies of racism. It is so illogic. People who value freedom and justice are perfectly capable of caring about multiple groups at once. We can care about the victims of Hamas's attacks and want justice for them and peace for their families. We can care about the Israeli hostages and want them home safely. And we can care about the 34,000 Palestinians who have been murdered and want that violence against them to end immediately. But the book was essentially finished by the time we reached this point. So I decided not to make any new additions because I felt like it would just be tacked on versus well integrated. So what I'm hoping people can do is use the book to think through situations beyond the ones that I included as examples in the book. I hope it inspires folks to view current and future situations and comments that people make and identify when they are coming from ways of thinking that are low-key functioning to support systems of dominance, wherever that may be in the world. And I hope that after readers say, oh, look, an example of that fallacy that I read about, that they won't keep it to themselves, but they will do something, however small, to loosen the grip that these fallacies have over our society.
I did think throughout this book about how the fallacies apply in terms of gender, in terms of sexuality, in terms of disabled people, just a variety of other groups that face oppression and marginalization, you know, of course, in the United States and other places as well. And the ongoing, you know, conflict in Gaza is a huge topic and one that is obviously of concern to many sociologists and other people. If you just look at Twitter, the things that are happening at Columbia and UCLA and the University of Texas and where else?
Dartmouth and Wisconsin.
Places that, you know, you and I know people and value those institutions and those departments and those individuals quite highly. And so it's a difficult time for many people who are trying to express their concern, their moral concern, their outrage over the response to the events of October 7th, which were terrifying for a lot of people. Jen, the book publishes in the UK tomorrow, May 3rd, and in the US, July 9th. I know you have many projects because you are a rock star faculty member here at the University of Alabama in Huntsville. What is next on your plate?
So fortuitously, this summer, right here in Huntsville, Alabama A&M University is hosting the National Civil Rights Conference. So I will be presenting on the book there. My talk will focus on three of the fallacies and demonstrate how they are impeding civil rights efforts. So, for example, we've already talked about the mens rea fallacy and how thinking racism has to be on purpose has resulted in civil rights backlash cases. But another fallacy is called the legalistic fallacy, the perspective that making laws will solve racism. And so that view is faulty because we've had civil rights laws for over 50 years, and yet there's still racism occurring. But also, as I say in that chapter, just having laws on the book doesn't guarantee civil rights protections if there's no enforcement of said laws, or if those set to enforce the laws are, in fact, the ones violating them. And from the 60s onwards, we've seen limited and sporadic enforcement of civil rights violations. So like the book, that talk is going to end by building on African-American studies professor Ruha Benjamin's concept of viral justice to describe some concrete personal and interpersonal work that one can do to identify and reject fallacies and work to build a more just society. Also this summer, I'll be finishing up my next book, which is called The Inequality of Racial Perception. This one's combining my qualitative research with mixed race people with my quantitative racial perception experiments to theorize how racial bias is actually baked in to everyday racialization, that is baked into the way that we not just treat people, but actually identify their race when we see them and interact with them. So that should be coming out from Oxford University Press in 2025.
All right, well, big congratulations on both the book talk coming up very soon and finishing up the book for Oxford. I know many people on our campus and beyond are excited about that text, but shouldn't overshadow this one, which is also well worth picking up and reading and sharing with others. You know, I wish there was like a major holiday coming around. We could just say, you know, put this in your gift basket. Well, I want to transition now to our banter segment. And I was asking a previous guest about summer plans for the academic with one or more children. So Jen, I know you're a parent. And so what are the plans in your household?
So my daughter is a competitive dancer. So she will be attending a summer dance camp for most of the summer, as well as a musical theater summer camp.
Nice.
She loves the performing arts. Yeah. And then in July, we're actually going to be on the road quite a bit. She has qualified for two summer intensive training programs, one in Orlando, and then all the way up 95 to another one in New York City. So I'll be doing that riding, but on the road this summer.
Awesome.
Yeah. What about you? What about your first summer here in Alabama? What's Archer doing?
Well, Archer is going to a lot of camps, as many camps as we can possibly get him into. If there are other people who have camps, or you just want a very energetic young child, like 11-year-old, call me, DMs are open.
Awesome. You can come over and go swimming with Roxy.
That sounds good. The one that I am kind of excited about for him actually is a fencing camp, which is a week long in Durham, North Carolina. But tell us more about Dance Mom life.
Oh my goodness. So if anyone's seen the show Dance Moms, that is an exaggeration, but yeah, only slightly so. Like take off a couple of zeros and take the cameras away. Mm-hmm. Now Dance Mom life is fine. I had my daughter my last year in graduate school, and I sort of just popped her in the baby Bjorn pocket in the front and kept on with my life. Got my first job, then got my tenure track job here. I gave my first job talk with her right there being held by one of my committee members, mm-hmm. taking her to conferences since she was three. And it wasn't until she really started competing competitively that I then had to switch my life and center dance versus centering my life. So now I kind of have dance at the center of my life, and then I fit in everything else around it just because it is really, really all encompassing. It works out. We get our schedule nice and early. So for example, I already know that we know where Southerns is going to be next year. We know where ASA conferences are going to be, and I know which dance competition she's going to be going to. So that's nice that it kind of functions sort of like the competitions like academic conferences where the schedule comes out nice and early and you can make your preparatory plans. But yes, I do have to always take that into account because it's a lot. She loves it, so it's worth it. But yeah, Dance Mom life is it's a lot.
Yes. Well, the things we do for and with our kids. So
yeah.
Yeah. Good stuff. Awesome. Well, you do these things well, Jen. So congratulations on making it all work. I know it takes a lot of effort.
Thank you.
Jen, it's so good to talk with you about your book, and I really enjoyed reading it and learning from it, and hopefully sharing it with a lot of students in the future and also other academics as well.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
My pleasure. You've been listening to The Annex, a sociology podcast. Special thanks to Dr. Jennifer Sims. Thanks also to our producer and to Joe Cohen, who directs the Queen's Podcast Lab. Music by Lena Orsa. Thanks, Lena.